Hello, everyone. My name is Raj Gandhi. I'm going to be talking about HIV-associated opportunistic infections. This is part three. The other two parts are during the live course, so please do join for some additional content. And I want to acknowledge Dr. Henry Mazur for sharing some of the slides that you'll see here. Here are my disclosures with commercial interests. And what we're going to be covering in this supplementary talk are a couple of different topics. We're going to cover mucocutaneous infections in people with advanced HIV, things like Candida, varicella zoster virus, herpes simplex virus, and Epstein-Barr virus, EBV-associated conditions. We'll also cover endemic mycoses. And finally, we're going to conclude with a discussion of gastrointestinal complications in people with HIV. So let's talk about mucocutaneous candidiasis. So oropharyngeal and esophageal candidiasis are really quite common in people with HIV who have a CD4 cell count of less than 200. Oral candidiasis can occur right around a CD4 count of 200, and even with CD4 counts around that are a little higher if the CD4 percentage is less than 14. But esophageal candidiasis, when the infection goes down into the esophagus, really occurs usually when the CD4 count is even lower than in oropharyngeal candidiasis. Almost all cases of candidiasis in people with HIV are due to Candida albicans, as opposed to some of the other species of Candida. And this is an important point, that invasive candidiasis, things like bloodstream infections, are not HIV related. Candida in the blood instead should raise suspicion of a catheter-related infection or injection drug use. Here are a couple of pictures of the different manifestations of oral candidiasis. On the left-hand side of the screen is what is called pseudomembranous candidiasis. This is when a patient has whitish plaques, usually in the posterior oropharynx. Importantly, these whitish plaques will scrape off with the tongue blade, so I always carry around a tongue blade with me to see if these plaques do scrape off. In the middle is what's called erythematous oropharyngeal candidiasis. This is essentially painful erythema in the posterior oropharynx. And then finally, on the right-hand side of the screen is what's called angular chelitis. This is due to candidiasis, but it's at the corners of the mouth. It can be quite painful. You can see fissuring. And this is treated sometimes not with systemic therapy, but just with topical antifungal therapy applied to the corners of the mouth. So these are three examples of how candidiasis can manifest in people with advanced HIV. Here's a picture of esophageal candidiasis. The plaques that we saw in the oropharynx now have extended into the esophagus. This is, of course, diagnosed by endoscopy. And when we talk about odynephagia, causes of painful swallowing in people with HIV, we're going to return to esophageal candidiasis. Here are some of the tips around management of mucocutaneous candidiasis. Fluconazole primary prophylaxis or chronic suppression is actually not recommended. That is not recommended. And that's because if there is prolonged usage of fluconazole, we can select for fluconazole-resistant candidiasis, and that can be very, very difficult to treat. Usually that requires much more difficult regimens in terms of treating. So we recommend avoiding primary prophylaxis or chronic suppression. Treatment of oral candidiasis is with oral fluconazole with 100 to 200 milligrams daily, except during pregnancy. There are also a number of topical options, things like topical miconazole. I'll often recommend clotrimazole troches. Patients can basically suck on these troches several times a day, or a nystatin. Those are topical treatments for oral candidiasis. As opposed to oral candidiasis, which can be treated topically, esophageal candidiasis should be treated with systemic therapy with fluconazole given orally for 14 to 21 days. In addition to candidiasis, another manifestation of HIV in the mouth is aphthous ulcers. These are some examples of aphthous ulcers. On the left-hand side of the screen is a punched-out ulcer in the mucocutaneous membrane. And then on the right-hand side of the screen, photograph courtesy of Dr. David Spock, is a black, as the black arrow is pointing to a large aphthous ulcer on the lip. These can be very, very difficult and used to be quite common when we had less good therapies for HIV. So I mentioned we would talk about odynephagia in people with advanced HIV. Here are the four most common causes of painful swallowing. Esophageal candidiasis leads the list, followed by giant aphthous ulcers. Those same aphthous ulcers that I showed you just now in the mouth can extend into the esophagus and manifest as severe odynephagia. herpes simplex virus can cause an esophagitis, and cytomegalovirus, which we're going to, which we cover in the in-person talk, can also cause esophagitis. The way this is usually approached is that people with HIV with a low CD4 count who have painful swallowing, odynephagia, will be given a course of oral fluconazole to see if there's a response. If there is, the presumption is that they have esophageal candidiasis. If they do not respond, however, then EGD is indicated, endoscopy is indicated, to look for either resistant candidiasis or to look for these giant aphthous ulcers, HSV or CMV, all of which are diagnosed on endoscopy. Now let's switch gears for a moment to herpes zoster. Herpes zoster is more frequent in people with HIV than in people without HIV, in people who are not on antiretroviral therapy. And before we had effective antiretroviral therapy, herpes zoster had a 15-fold higher incidence in people with HIV than in people without HIV. In the antiretroviral era and in people on antiretrovirals, there's still an increased risk even on suppressive treatment. A localized zoster is dermatomal. It may occur at all CD4 cell counts. It is more frequent when the CD4 cell count is less than 200 or if the HIV RNA is not suppressed. An important point to make here is that the risk of zoster is increased soon after a person initiates on antiretroviral therapy, and this is thought to be because of an immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. So don't be surprised if you have a patient who starts ART and then some weeks later develops dermatomal zoster. That is seen reasonably frequently and is thought to be an iris phenomenon. Here are some examples of localized and disseminated herpes zoster. We'll talk about ophthalmic zoster in some detail. But on the top left is dermatomal zoster, clustered papules and vesicles in a single dermatome. There's also an entity called herpes sinusoster, where you can get pain and other manifestations of herpes zoster without the rash. In the bottom left-hand corner is disseminated zoster. This is indistinguishable from primary varicella. And then finally, ophthalmic zoster with the on the bottom right can be a particularly severe manifestation of zoster. So let's talk about zoster ophthalmicus. This is when the varicella zoster virus reactivates in the ophthalmic branch of cranial nerve 5. On the left-hand part of the screen is a diagram that shows you that ophthalmic branch, and you can see on the right-hand part really that dermatomal or ophthalmic branch reactivation results in a very characteristic appearance in terms of how the rash is. You see it's not crossing the midline, for example. Another important point here is a finding called Hutchinson sign. This is a precursor to VZV eye disease. This represents reactivation in the nasociliary nerve of the ophthalmic branch of cranial nerve 5. It manifests as vesicles on the tip of the nose, that's shown in the top left-hand corner with the arrow, or vesicles on the side of the nose. So if you see a patient who has that Hutchinson sign, be on the lookout for varicella zoster, and particularly be on the lookout for ophthalmic zoster. It can accompany other ocular manifestations of VZV. It can, for example, VZV can cause a keratitis, which is a corneal problem, shown on the bottom left, or an anterior uveitis. And finally, VZV can cause a retinitis. And so these are really important things to be on the lookout for if you see evidence of Hutchinson's sign. Zoster ophthalmicus can also manifest as a stroke, and this is thought to be due to vascular inflammation and occlusion. In the angiogram, in the picture here, you see occlusion on the angiogram, and this is a complication of this vascular inflammation. It occurs days or months after zoster, with a median of about 4 months. Occasionally, cutaneous lesions may be absent about a third of the time. And the diagnosis of zoster ophthalmicus-related stroke depends on doing a lumbar puncture, getting a CSF sample, looking for VZV on PCR, or looking for what we call intrathecal production of VZV antibodies. What does that mean? It means that you measure the VZV antibody in the CSF, you measure that level, compare it to the level of VZV antibody in the serum, and if there's a higher level in the CSF, that's a reflection of intrathecal production, and that's evidence for VZV infection of the CNS, which can present, as I mentioned, with a stroke. Ramsay-Hunt is also a complication. This is herpes zoster otitis. It represents reactivation of VZV and the genicular ganglion of cranial nerve 7. It can present with external ear vesicles and facial nerve paralysis. So some of the hallmarks of Ramsey-Hunt include ear pain with a vesicular rash on the external ear. There can also be a lower motor neuron paralysis of the facial nerve, not an upper motor neuron, but a lower motor neuron paralysis of the facial nerve, so a facial droop. There can be loss of taste sensation over the anterior two-thirds of the tongue. And because of edema, there can also be cranial nerve 8 palsies. This can manifest as hearing loss, tinnitus, and even vertigo. So these are some of the characteristic features of the Ramsey-Hunt syndrome. One word about prevention of zoster. There's a recombinant VZV vaccine, the RZV vaccine. This is the vaccine that is used widely for prevention of zoster. It's recommended in adults with HIV who are 18 years of age or older, regardless of CD4 cell count. It's a two-dose series at month zero and then 2 to 6 months later. Should not be given, the RZV should not be given during an acute episode of herpes zoster. There are recent evidence in people without HIV, but also in people with HIV, that the zoster vaccine not only reduces the incidence of zoster, what it's designed to do, but also reduces the incidence of dementia. And that really is a really important finding that has been discovered relatively recently. Herpes simplex virus bears discussion as well. This is, can be found on the orolabial surfaces. This is the most common manifestation of HSV-1 is orolabial herpes. Genital herpes has typically been HSV-2, but is increasingly due to HSV-1. Recurrences and viral shedding are more common with HSV-2 than with HSV-1. That is, when there's genital HSV-1, it is less likely to recur and there's less likely to be viral shedding than with HSV-2. HSV can also cause proctitis in men who have sex with men. The proctitis can be quite painful, and there may not be external anal ulcers, so have a high index of suspicion and look for HSV in people who have proctitis. There are some other important manifestations. We touched on HSV esophagitis. These are things that occur when the CD4 count is low, typically less than 100, so HSV esophagitis that presents with odynophagia. HSV can also cause retinitis. It's quite a severe acute retinal necrosis that HSV can cause. And then HSV can also cause, and this is really important because it's quite difficult to manage, it can also cause chronic, extensive, deep genital ulcers that are often acyclovir resistant. In a moment, I'll show you a picture of that. But if you have a patient with advanced HIV who has a extensive, deep genital ulcer, do think of HSV and do think of acyclovir resistance. Disseminated HSV is really quite rare, even in severely immunocompromised people with HIV. So that's an important point to make as well. So here's localized herpes simplex, these clustered vesicles on an erythematous base, very typical appearance of localized herpes simplex. And here's what I mentioned before, a very large heaped up ulcer, a large ulcer with a heaped up border, perirectal in location. In this particular patient, this individual also has a low CD4 count, quite painful, quite extensive. If you see this type of ulcer in a person with advanced HIV, not only look for HSV, but look for acyclovir resistance, so do a viral culture and send for phenotypic testing. The treatment for acyclovir-resistant HSV can be quite difficult. Intravenous foscarnet is usually used. There is an investigational drug called pritelivir, which is being evaluated. It's not yet FDA approved, but something to keep your eye on for the future. Okay, we're going to shift gears to a couple of other manifestations in the mouth. And this is oral hairy leukoplakia. This particular condition is related to Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV. The way OHL manifests, oral hairy leukoplakia presents, is usually with whitish plaques on the side of the tongue. These are several examples. You remember that I made the point that candida in the mouth is scrapable with a tongue blade. If you see a whitish plaque and it scrapes off with the tongue blade, think candida. Oral hairy leukoplakia, though, is affixed to the mucocutaneous surface. It does not scrape off with a tongue blade. And that can be helpful when you're trying to sort out candida versus OHL. Here's another example, a particularly prominent example of those whitish plaques on the side of the tongue. This is oral hairy leukoplakia. HIV diseases that are associated with Epstein-Barr virus, in addition to oral hairy leukoplakia, include primary CNS lymphoma. In one of the in-person lectures that we talked about focal brain lesions in HIV, we talked about some of the clues for primary CNS lymphoma, but this is also an EBV-associated complication in people with advanced HIV, presents with a focal brain lesion, and more discussion in that lecture. It's the OI lecture, part two. Some other important dermatologic findings in people with HIV include prurigo nodularis. These are deep-seated subcutaneous nodules, often hyperpigmented in areas of pruritus, so in areas of excoriation. They can be sometimes hard to distinguish these from Kaposi's sarcoma. Kaposi's sarcoma, which is a human herpes virus 8-associated complication, usually presents with these purplish plaques on the extremities, but often sometimes on the face as well, which can be quite cosmetically disturbing. So purplish plaques in a person with a low CD4 count and HIV, I think Kaposi's sarcoma. One other complication of Kaposi's sarcoma that we sometimes see when it's on the lower extremities can be lymphedema. So this can be really very, very severe. If you see Kaposi's sarcoma and accompanying lymphedema, that can be complicated to manage and is one of the complications of Kaposi's. Essentially, the lymph nodes and the lymph drainage is affected by the tumor, and you can get difficult to manage lymphedema. So now let's shift gears from the mucocutaneous complications of HIV to talk about some of the endemic mycoses. So throughout the ID board review course, a number of the fungal diseases mentioned here are covered in detail. So look for questions that are in patients with HIV, but then also have a manifestation of an endemic mycosis. So for example, histoplasma, this morphologically is small yeast that are showing narrow based budding. These are 2 to 5 microns in size with narrow based buds. This is different than blastomyces, another endemic mycosis, where you get larger yeast forms, 10 to 15 microns, and the budding is what we call broad based budding. So broad based budding of blasto versus the narrow based budding of histo. Coccidioides is very, very different morphologically. Here you will have very large spherules. These are full of endospores. Here are two good examples, a silver stain on the left. So these are 25 to 100 micron spherules with these endospores, very different than blasto and histo. And then finally, pericoccidioides, which is in South America predominantly, gives you what is called a pilot wheel appearance, example here. And this pilot wheel is about 10 to 20 microns in size. So endemic mycoses in people with HIV. One endemic mycosis that I want to spend a few minutes on is Tayloromyces marneffei. This used to be called Penicillium marneffei. This is a dimorphic fungus. It's found in Southeast Asia, East Asia, and South Asia. The endemic and hyperendemic regions are shown on this map. The risk factor for severe disease is having advanced HIV with a CD4 count of less than 200. It can give you skin lesions. I'm showing you a picture here, and I'll show you a few more pictures in a moment. The skin lesions are central necrotic or umbilicated papules. Remember that term, umbilicated papules, because there's a couple of other things in addition to Tayloromyces that can give umbilicated papules. If you see this in the right part of the world, in a person with advanced HIV, think Tayloromyces. In addition to umbilicated papules in the skin, you can also get pulmonary, gastrointestinal involvement, and you can get hepatosplenomegaly. So here are some additional pictures. Here's a different patient with HIV with the umbilicated papules. Here's in the middle is a CT scan showing the pulmonary involvement with Tayloromyces. And then finally, histologically, the way Tayloromyces looks is you get these round to oval organisms, 3 to 6 microns in diameter, so closer to size to histo. But importantly, and this is a distinguishing factor, you'll see a midline septum in a dividing yeast cell. That arrow on the right-hand side shows you an example of a midline septum in a dividing yeast cell. If you see this in the right clinical setting, in the right part of the world, think Tayloromyces. Recently, the Department of Health and Human Services in the U.S. updated their primary prophylaxis recommendations for Tayloromycosis. Indications for primary prophylaxis include a CD4 cell count of less than 100 and not taking antiretroviral therapy or treatment failure. And people who either live in a hyperendemic area, and this is defined as northern Thailand, Vietnam, and southern China, these are the areas of the world that have the highest incidence. They're called hyperendemic. or a traveler to one of these hyperendemic areas. These are the people who would have an indication for primary prophylaxis. The preferred primary prophylaxis for tularemycosis is with itraconazole, 200 milligrams daily. An alternative option is fluconazole, 400 milligrams once weekly. And so finally, to kind of bring some of this together, here are some examples of skin lesions, with several of these being endemic mycoses. These can be hard to distinguish, often rely on a biopsy to make the diagnosis. So tularemices with the umbilicated papules. Cryptococcosis, we spend a good amount of time on that topic in the in-person lecture, part two of the OI series. This can cause umbilicated papules, as shown here. Systemic symptoms, very similar to tularemices, but morphologically on biopsy will be very different. Histoplasma on the right can also give you an umbilicated papule. And then molluscum, which is a very common cause of umbilicated papules in people with HIV, as shown here. Molluscum, though, will not present with the systemic symptoms of fever and headache and some of the other systemic symptoms that you get with the endemic mycoses. Let's talk now about gastrointestinal complications of HIV. And here we're going to start with causes of diarrhea in people with HIV. CMV colitis is a very, very important cause of diarrhea in people with HIV. It's a bloody diarrhea. It's hemorrhagic. There can be intestinal perforation. And it occurs when the CD4 cell count is less than 100. We talk about CMV in OI part two, but CMV colitis, important part of the differential for bloody diarrhea in a person with advanced HIV. Let's move from CMV to bacterial causes. Here we have Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter, E. coli. Don't forget Clostridioides difficile. C. difficile can cause diarrhea. Even sometimes in people who have not received antibiotics, if they have advanced HIV. Other causes, bacterial causes of diarrhea include sexually transmitted infections. We mentioned proctitis in the context of HSV, but lymphogranuloma venereum, chlamydial infection, gonorrhea, GC, and syphilis can also cause proctitis. Mycobacterium avium can cause diarrhea. Here, the CD4 count is less than 50. But in addition to the diarrhea, people will have fevers and systemic symptoms, wasting, weight loss, often elevated alkaline phosphatase. So that's another consideration if you see it with the accompanying features. Some of the parasitic causes of diarrhea include microsporidiosis and cryptosporidiosis. These are usually occurring in people whose CD4 count is less than 100. They can cause chronic diarrhea. Microsporidiosis and cryptosporidiosis can also cause extraintestinal manifestations, things like biliary disease, pulmonary disease, even occasionally a neurologic disease. So in people with advanced HIV, something to consider, ocular disease. Cystoisospora is another parasitic cause of diarrhea. It's formerly called Dysospora. Cyclospora, Giardia, and amoebiasis kind of round out the list of parasitic causes of diarrhea in people with HIV. Cancer. Kaposi sarcoma, we mentioned already, can cause cutaneous disease, but it can also cause gastrointestinal disease. And when it does so, people can have diarrhea, and same with lymphoma. And then finally, a really important point not to lose sight of is medications. Antiretroviral therapy itself can cause diarrhea, particularly HIV protease inhibitors, used less commonly now than in the past. We're usually using integrase inhibitors, but in some people who are still requiring protease inhibitors, diarrhea can be a common complication. And then antibiotics, of course, in anybody can cause diarrhea, including in people with HIV. How do we evaluate diarrhea in people with HIV? For acute diarrhea, we send a stool CNS, as well as C. difficile testing, again, even if they haven't had antibiotics recently. For chronic diarrhea, again, send a stool CNS as well as C. diff, but also send a stool ONP, test for cryptosporidia, microsporidia, isospora. Cyclospora, these are done by stains. Giardia can be tested for through an antigen test. And if there's proctitis, painful defecation with systemic symptoms, sometimes do sexually transmitted infection screening. If there's diarrhea, fever, and systemic symptoms, and the CD4 count is less than 50, send an AFB blood culture. A single blood culture is sufficient for MAC. Don't need to send two, but send an AFB blood culture and look for evidence for cytomegalovirus. And then if the above evaluation is unrevealing, have a low threshold to go on to endoscopy to look for some of the rarer causes of a diarrhea in people with HIV. Salmonella is a really important bacterial infection with people with HIV. Bacteremia with Salmonella is more common in people with HIV, especially those with low CD4 cell counts, than people without HIV. In fact, if you see someone with Salmonella bacteremia, make sure that they have an HIV test on the books. Recently, it merits HIV testing because of this close association between HIV and Salmonella bacteremia. Unless antiretroviral therapy is given, recurrence is really quite common. Back in the 1980s and 90s, before we had effective therapy, I used to see very frequent recurrences of Salmonella bacteremia before we could get the HIV under control. Thankfully, that's less common now. I want to spend a moment on Shigella, because over the last few years, there's been a rising tide of Shigella drug resistance. Back in 2018, the CDC put out a bulletin that there were increasing number of Shigella isolates that test susceptible to ciprofloxacin with an MIC of 0.12 to 1 microgram per mil, but do harbor resistance genes. So the clue here is kind of a creep on the MIC. At that point, the DHHS recommended treatment be considered, but may be withheld if the CD4 count is very, very high and if the symptoms are mild, because in some instances, the Shigella will be self-limited and resolved. One counseling point is to wait patients, counsel patients to wait to have sex for 1 to 2 weeks after the diarrhea resolves. So that was in 2018. But more recently in 2026, the CDC updated their testing and pointed out that there's been a really rapid and important rise in the last number of years for what they call XDR Shigella. This is extensively drug resistant Shigella. In fact, in 2026, 8.5% of Shigella isolates tested were resistant to azithromycin, ampicillin, ciprofloxacin, ceftriaxone, and trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. So about 1 in 12 or so isolates were XDR. About a third of them are Shigella flexneri. The rest are Shigella, mostly Shigella sonii. About 38% of this case series were the people were hospitalized. There were no deaths. Some of the risk factors for XDR Shigella from prior studies include men who have sex with men, people experiencing homelessness, and people with HIV. There are no current treatment recommendations. Some of the drugs that are used outside of the U.S. Are shown here. They might be effective, but they're not approved yet for treatment of shigellosis. So with that, I want to thank you for your attention. Please join us for the other two parts of the OI lecture series, and we look forward to seeing you during the course, and thank you again. Bye-bye.